Hi, welcome to the Say Your Piece Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio with your host, Salita McCall, as we discuss various topics such as social issues, communication, books, and current events. This is Say Your Piece Radio Network with your host, Salita McCall. And I'm here today with Dr. Velva Bowles. I'm looking at two different screens, you guys. I'm sorry. And we're going to be talking to her in a moment. But I want to first welcome you to the show. Welcome to any new listeners that are out there. I want to allow you guys, if you want to call in at any time, you can call in at 347-677-1749. That's 346-677-1749. And as you know, the elections are over with. I'm going to do a show on that. We're going to talk about politics later on. But we're working on our series. It's called Women in Motion, and we're talking to African-American women who are successful in their businesses, in their life, things that they're doing for their communities. We're going to talk on that in that area. In the meantime, I'm going to get Dr. Bowles on the line. Dr. Bowles, are you already there?
I'm here.
Hello. How are you tonight, ma'am?
I am doing very well, thank you.
Great, 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 great. So, as I said earlier, we have the elections out the way. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of people happy and a few very sad.
Yeah. But, you know, we got to move on to bigger and better things. All it does is tell us to get ready for the next thing that's coming. Get prepared for that. What we're going to do is we want you to tell our listening audience about you. And then once we get all the information, we're going to talk about your book. We're going to talk about other events and situations or things that you have been in lately in the last couple of weeks or two, maybe a couple of months, okay? So start off by telling
you. Just telling people who I am. I usually start at the very beginning, born in North Carolina. And went to North Carolina State as a basic bachelor's degree, traveled from North Carolina to West Africa, where I taught chemistry in Monrovia and Kakata, Liberia. When I returned to the United States, I worked in industry. I was with Westinghouse Electric Corporation for 7 years, and during that time, I worked with the Navy. Naval reactors were the area, and the title was chemical expert. I got an advanced degree, a master's in chemistry at Duquesne University while in Pittsburgh, and really enjoyed the experience with Westinghouse, traveled over the various places where ships were docked, and actually was aboard submarines and the aircraft carrier, the Nimitz, was the primary one that I worked with. Once I had worked with Westinghouse, I went from there to medical school at the University of Pittsburgh and enrolled into an MD-PhD program where I worked with a group with classical pathology and the other group that was studying in that program, we worked with artificial intelligence. So once I finished in the University of Pittsburgh, I went on to pursue the science side, and that's why I describe myself as a physician scientist. I traveled to Colorado State University, where I worked in their biochemistry department on a project which was molecular biology. And while I was there, I had outstanding experience working with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. A number of people are not aware that there is a branch in Fort Collins, Colorado. Most people think of Atlanta, Georgia, but the Fort Collins, Colorado branch is the zoonotic, meaning they work with all of the diseases like the malaria, yellow fever, hantavirus, and so forth. So that was an exciting time. I did a year there and started to do some clinical work with Dr. Hogan at a local hospital and decided I was ready to do my residency, and I traveled to New Orleans, Louisiana, for Tulane Medical Center, where I did internal medicine pediatrics. And I worked in New Orleans as my base, that's where I had a home, until the Hurricane Katrina came, and it took it all. Took my clinic, took my house and some dear friends, even took my dog. So at that point, I relocated to Central Louisiana, where I now reside.
Mm.
How's that?
Look, that's a book by itself, huh?
Yes, it's quite a long story.
So you think of all the things that you've had to transition and adjust to. Has that changed your perception of how you see things?
Almost definitely. And I don't know how candid I can be, but...
You can be as candid as you want on my show. I have no... You can cuss on my show.
Well,
I don't have no provisions on my show.
In North Carolina, I grew up at a low socioeconomic level. Both parents were hard workers. Mom was a homemaker, mother of 8 children, and she was very much involved in homework and PTA, and she sewed, she ironed, and she even took in wash. I mean, you hear about that, and you see these on the different movies like The Help. Well, my family actually took in other people's dirty clothes and washed them, and Mom was known for how well she could put in a starch. My oldest sister could be a master tailor because she was the one chosen to do most of the ironing for the rich people who paid us to do their clothes. While Mom did domestics such as that, Dad worked a number of jobs. He was a brick mason, a block mason. He worked in a mill. But in the time that I was growing up, North Carolina was extremely prejudiced, and they did not allow my father to work at his aptitude. They said they did not hire, and I'll be nice and say, black men in the mill where he applied, and he was allowed to sweep up the area, and the millwrights would send him to go and get tools, and he was allowed to cut the lawn and to do the hedges. And this went on until one night they were on tight deadline, and one of their major machines went down. This was a textile mill. And Dad had an amazing aptitude. He did not go to college. He was born in 1916, and what I learned growing up in the household, that in the South, there were no high schools for black people. You may not have known that. Highest school they could go was 7th grade, and they literally had to travel to another place to start 8th through 12 if they ever got that chance, and it cost money. It wasn't free. So both my parents went to 7th grade, but that was as far as public school was available to black people in the South at their time that they were in school. So Dad had an amazing self-taught knowledge base. I mean, I wish I were as bright as he. But he had been aware one machine had what he called a high-pitched whine for some time. And while he was sweeping up this area, he knew that something was wrong with the machine. So when it went out, it was like 11:30 at night, and as my dad referred to some of the young people who wanted to be in control, he called them straw bosses. He says one of the straw bosses came and he was frantic. He was doing everything he could see. He called in their mechanics. No one was fixing it. Finally, he looks over. My dad's name was Emmanuel. Of course, they gave him no handle using his last name. They called him Big E. You know, they like giving us such names. So they said, Big E, do you know anything about machines? He said, yes. He said, do you, any way you know how to fix this? And I think of this, Salita, and when you're title of your show, Women in Motion, I smile because I look forward to when I can gather my thoughts and energies and actually tell the story of how much I admire my parents and what they did under hardship. Dad said he looked at the man, and here's what he told us. Now, this is a version to the family. He says, I knew that that machine needed another flywheel belt, that the belt had been slipping for a while. And without that belt, it could not turn the engine, and therefore it shut down when that belt finally stopped grabbing. So here's what Dad did that makes me smile to tell the story. He wore Brogaine shoes. Now, these are heavy leather shoes. Some people may recognize what I'm talking about. And the shoelaces were cowhide. You didn't have regular cloth or string shoelaces, really leather. He undid mm-hmm. his boots and took out his shoestrings. And I remember one of my brothers said, "Daddy, why did you do that?" He says, "Well, I tied the shoelaces together, and I was going to wrap it around this flywheel, and it will serve as the belt." And someone says, "Well, Dad, didn't they have more belts they could replace it?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Why would you use your shoestring then?" Here's the part he gets, Mr. Leader. He says, "Well, shoelaces were not meant to do the job. So if I use the shoelaces, I would be sure they would need me again." Mm-hmm. Now tell me if that's not smart.
That was smart.
Think about that. So he goes and he puts this temporary fix. And, of course, they're happy, but he gets no credit. You know, the next morning when they're on schedule, no one said Big E came and saved us. So it went on like a week or so later, and during prime time when the big bosses, the real old men with the money, were walking through, the machine failed again. And they said, "Well, has this ever happened before?" Well, the straw boss had to admit, "Yes, it has." And said, "How did you fix it before?" Because the same mechanics, nobody knew how to fix it. He said, "Big E fixed it." So the owner, I mean, his name was Mr. Dover, the owner came and said, "Do you know how to fix this?" My dad said, "Yes." And he says, "Well, will you fix it?" My dad said, "Okay." And the first thing he said is, "I need someone to go to the supply closet and bring me a number 10 flywheel belt." And from that moment, he was chosen to go and represent the company and get training. So he got his associate degree in air conditioning and heating based on that experience. And that's what I call cunning. See, I would have been foolhardy enough to tell the man, "Go get a belt and fix it," and walk away and never hear about it again. But my dad knew if he used his leather shoelaces mm-hmm. that he would be able to temporarily fix that problem. And he understood mm-hmm. the people enough to know they wouldn't give him any credit. And consequently, mm-hmm. he decided to completely, you know, do what was in his best interest. And that's why I said I wish I were as cunning as he is or was. He died in 2008. But he has a number of little stories where he saw the problem, understood the big picture, and took a little piece of it so that he would have to be invited back to the table. So I feel real, real proud that that's the type of mentality and type of people that I sprung from. But to answer your question, being black female and thrown in right into the, I say, tidal wave of integration. Mm-hmm. I've been tossed, I've been turned, I've been waterlogged, and I guess the only thing that kept me afloat is my belief that if I really, really wanted it, nothing could stop me from getting it. And mm-hmm. I think that has persevered over the years. I may have to stop for a time and reroute myself. Mm-hmm. But the sadness of the whole experience is the isolation. Mm-hmm. When I was at, I think I mentioned it to you when I was in Tuskegee a couple of weekends ago, at their 62nd annual convention in Alabama. It was an NAACP convention. I was talking on the topic of bonding is power. And when I talked about integration, I said the biggest negative, and I can list probably several, but the biggest is the isolation, that I was always in the midst of where I was hated. That when I went to middle school, I got spitballs. If no one knows what that is, they chew up paper till it's real
and
yucky and throw it. No, not spit mm-hmm. it. They put it in and they throw it. And when it hits, mm-hmm. it hits with such force that it splatters out. So I'd have mm-hmm. spitballs in my hair. And it's hard even to get it out of your hair. I mean, it's somebody else's spit, and it's like chewing gum to some extent. So it's just very gross. And I can remember mm-hmm. being on the bus and getting spitballs in the back of my neck or spitballs in my hair. The first time I ever got the full gravity of what it was to be mistreated for no reason other than your color, I was in about seventh grade. And I had always liked languages, so I was reading French at that time, and there was a young woman who was from Canada, and they were real proud at this school they could offer French. And there I was, a fly in the buttermilk, the only little black thing in all of the whole room who could really read the French. So the instructiveness to the South racism, I guess to the degree that it was, chose me to read one part, and she chose another young man to read my counterpart. He was the husband, I was the wife, and I didn't think twice. And I start out saying, "Bonjour, Ray, ça va bien?" You know, how, you know, "Hello, Henry, how are you? Are you well?" And the entire class, I mean, 29 to 30 students, almost in stereo, started saying, "Ah, Henry, you have a N-word wife." And I was shocked.
Man.
And I was like, these are my classmates. Why are they doing that? And this young man just turned red. I mean, his face was like he lit him up on fire. And the teacher didn't know what to do. She stood there, and they didn't stop. They continued heckling. And I was looking at her and looking back at the guy who never read his part. So she puts her hand on my shoulders and ushers me in the hallway, and she starts to say, and she was so flustered, she started in French, but she went on to say, I'm so sorry. Listen, I don't know what you should do. Maybe you should go and sit in the principal's office. And I never forgot, how was I the one to report as if being disciplined when I was the victim?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that pattern repeats itself over and over and over. That's why when you ask me, every time there was a outburst or an aggression, they selected me to leave the environment, and they put me into detention, or they put me into isolation. And this was their solution.
Because they didn't know how to handle the situation?
Well, as I said, I don't think anyone has candidly talked to those of us who were really the integration babies. Because I've never heard anyone tell these stories before. The closest I ever came was another professional who once said to me, "Velva, you know what? We've integrated out of our own race, but we will never integrate into theirs." Now, we were both professionals.
Exactly.
She was a lawyer, and at the time I was in marketing. And I listened to what she said, but we never had a candid conversation of here's what happened to me and here's what happened to me. But as I've gotten older, I really think we need to document it, and we need to talk about it, because I think the idea, my dad thought, he believed firmly that if only the white majority could see how smart black kids are, if only white majority could see how well black people could work. And he had this strong belief that if only they could see, then all of this ugliness would go away and all this prejudice would dissolve. Well, Dad's gone now, and I would tell him, as I do when I visit his gravesite, "Dad, you were wrong. All the degrees that I were able to get and all of the time I spent integrating in, it only allowed me permission to be present. It did not give me acceptance."
The question is, do we want acceptance?
When I say acceptance, I'm not trying to say into a white culture or into a black culture. Acceptance to me is if I walk and say, "Hi, Selita," and you say, "Hey, girl, how you doing?" There is a kind of familiarity and acceptance that you know who I am, I know who you are, I'm not threatened by you, you're not threatened by me, that kind of acceptance. When I was in the majority, and it's been all my life, like I said, I went through a high school, there was only three black people out of the entire high school because there was a math dropout. When I was at University of North Carolina State, there were 1,200 women in the dorm, and three women were in that dormitory. So when I say really minority, I'm not kidding. I'm not saying 10%. I'm saying like 1% or less. And being chronically in that setting, you either do one of two things. One, you totally deny yourself and try to identify with the group. I refused to do that. In fact, I felt like I needed to be more in tune with what it was to be black when I was so much in that environment. I remember when I cut off all my hair because there was no hair products. At the time, Jared Curl was popular, and I had grown up, if you did your hair and you straightened it, it was a hot comb. Well, in the middle of this island called North Carolina State, there was no black hairstylist. There was no black churches, not that I knew of. I had no car. I had no relatives. So I was one of the first to literally, some even called me butch, because when I cut off all my hair, women just didn't do that. You didn't go around with that very short. I had less a half inch to an inch of hair, but I did it because there's no way I could groom it. I didn't have what I needed, and there was no resource and no one to talk to about it. I remember how upset my dad was. He says, I have four boys and four girls. What you coming here looking like one of the boys for? Well, hey, you know, I got to make a choice. I don't know what else to do. So there were a number of isolating events. I mean, it's just, first of all, I'm isolating for my family because I don't have the female or feminine look my dad preferred, but I had to have that look to survive because I didn't have any grooming tools in the environment I was put into. There was no sorority, so I didn't pledge anything. And I was always the invader. There's a special feeling when, say, you're in a dormitory life and everybody there, you know, you're doing the same things. You walk in a room and the room goes silent. You know that your presence is intrusive. My first semester, they assigned at North Carolina State as freshmen, you had to stay with your assigned roommate for 1 week, and then you could, you know, put in for a move for whatever reason. And I never forget, because I went off to school age 16, and I'm just this really naive person thinking I'm ready for my new adventure, and I'm there on National Merit Scholarship, so I didn't really have any friends or family to talk to. And this young lady comes in, and she's this real petite, very fair white skin with almost water-clear-looking eyes and very, very blonde, almost white platinum hair. And she walks in the room. She looks at me, and she sits on the bed across the room because, you know, college room had these tiny little beds on either side of the room, and she starts to cry. And I thought, oh, she's so homesick. So I rush over to her, Selena, and I sit down beside her, and I said, it's going to be okay. You know, you're going to miss your mother. And all I could do, she wouldn't stop crying. So I go down the hall, and I'm looking left and right, and I see someone. I said, maybe you can help her. She won't stop crying. So several of the white girls in the hall came into the room. They sat on the bed with her, and they're talking to her. And finally, when she's able to talk, and I don't know if you've ever cried real hard, you kind of go, you can't really get your words out. She started to talk, and she says, I can't stay in a room with this nigga because nobody at home will talk to me. And I was shocked. I'm standing there thinking how I'm worried about her getting somebody to talk to her. And do you know she slept on the floor in one of the other girls' rooms for the entire week until she could put in to get a different roommate? That was my welcome to North Carolina State experience. And the next person they put me with was a Mormon. I don't know which was worse. The Mormon would come, and if I, you know, when I'm just waking up in the morning, she'd come and sit on my bed like some kind of apparition or specter. And I'd open my eyes, and there's this woman sitting there on my bed, and she'd say, you know that if you ever need anything, you should tell me because God hears my prayers 20 times sooner than yours. And I'm looking like, what? He says, because you're dark-skinned it. Oh, you got to get the rest of it now. You're dark-skinned it. And because Cain killed Abel and God put that dark mark on his head, you were the mark of the first murder. And consequently, you will need someone to ask God things that you want because you need intercession since you wear the mark of the first murder. I laid down the first time I heard it, and I went, what? Yes, you're so dark-skinned, you need someone to intercede. And I'll be glad to pray for whatever it is you need. And I sat up in the bed, and here I am, the 16-year-old, away from home, you know, all my hair cut off. I'm lonely. I'm sad. And this woman just told me God didn't love me. You know, God didn't love you. So I had to work on that and do my academics. You know, that was a pretty heavy chore. So, I mean, I could go on and on for all the different instances of having to overcome what others don't even know exists.
But you've adjusted very well. I mean, you look at you now, and, you know, me and you talk, first of all, listening audience, if you don't know, me and Dr. Bowles are very familiar with each other, and she kind of knows my personality, and I kind of know hers. So she's adjusted very well to everything that she's been through. She takes it a little bit lighter than I would have. But like you say, you have to adjust wherever you're at. You have to be adaptable. And I, at times in my life, I didn't have an opportunity to be adaptable, and I just kind of lashed out and, like, let them know where
to get off it. So that's the kind of attitude I have sometimes. But you did learn how to be able to adapt to whatever situation you were in, and you were able to even kind of brush it off your shoulder because you had one thing on your mind, and that was to get your education so that you can move on to something different. So you have to put your mindset in that, put yourself in that mindset and forget about all the stuff that's around you and just concentrate, you know, on it.
Well,
I know it was hard.
Well, I mean, forgetting it is one thing, that, and I'm just telling you the emotional side. Now, keep in mind, or maybe you didn't know, there were some who ran interference. I mean, direct interference wasn't just something I could brush off. When I first went to the University of Pittsburgh, my biggest shock, I went on fellowship, and first people didn't believe I was black. They kept looking for this student that's coming in on fellowship, and I'd be right there, and they keep saying, well, we haven't met our new da-da-da-da, and I'm standing there, so, well, I'm okay, yeah, sure. And they keep on talking around me. And when they finally found out that I was coming in based on my GRE and GMAT scores, that I was the recipient of that fellowship, there was a professor who went to the chairman, and this is what he said, because I got a copy of the letter. Now, just to show you, and I say God is good. I believe so much in law of attraction and believing in positive and having positive come to you. When I was at Westinghouse, all those years before, like I said, I was at Westinghouse for 7 years, so way before I went to med school, I used to have a secretary pool that worked with me when I was doing the marketing part for the Navy. And there was one particular woman, we were about peers in age, she wasn't that much younger, but she was really good. She typed well, she was efficient, and I would always give her the extra. You know, if I had some money given to me by the marketing department to hire somebody to do extra typing, I'd always call her up and say, are you available? And she had a young family, and she really appreciated it. Now, why am I telling you this? I don't know, 9 years later, you know, I've moved from Westinghouse to Gulf Oil and other places. Now I'm at med school. She has since also grown. She had moved from working as a secretary in a secretary pool at Westinghouse to being a private administrative assistant to the registrar's office. So I didn't know her path of travel. She didn't know mine. But it happened that when I was there presenting myself at the medical school, this professor, unknown to me, went to the chairperson and requested the following. He said, because we know they steal, that means me, black people,
okay,
I request that the key that you give her as a graduate student cannot get in other labs, even if that meant changing the locks from all the other labs so that the key I got was specific to the one department, which was pathology, and could not open any other door. Now, he wrote this as a letter. Now, how do I know it? This same secretary, who is now administrative assistant, sees a copy of this letter, which was put in my file and sent to the registrar's office. Now, I've done nothing wrong, but this is how, if you don't know how dirty, how backstabbing, how evil people are, when she was filing things, she read it, and she knew me, because we worked together 9 years earlier. So she went to the registrar or the dean or whomever, and she says, I know personally this is a racist letter. It should not be tolerated. And she talked to them, so they called me to the registrar or dean's office. And I didn't know why. And when I came in, I'd never met this person. I think his name was Dr. Krasois. And he sat down, and he says, well, it's been brought to my attention. There's something been put in your folder, and we feel it's necessary for you to see it. And if you'd like to write a rebuttal, you may. And so I'm calling you. And I'm just so innocent. So wait, I didn't have a clue. I hadn't made any enemies. I didn't know anybody. So I read the letter, and I couldn't help but tears start to stream because Dad had told me there are people that's just mean, just evil. And, you know, I said, well, that seems like, you know, you're kind of tough. Because he couldn't cite an example. I couldn't even breathe for a few minutes. I'm reading this where it says, those people steal, and I do not want her in my lab after hours. And I've never met the man. Turns out he was from Norway or Sweden or something, and the way in which he was even a professor in the department was a backdoor thing. He came as somebody's assistant and worked as a lab technician so many years and took courses like 15 years to get his doctorate degree and then was put on staff. You know, that never happens at a big university unless you got somebody, you know, rooting for you. I read it. I couldn't contain myself. I just said this. So when I got myself back together and I was sitting there, so Dr. Kirkland has asked me, do you want to write a rebuttal? And I said, what am I supposed to say? I'm not black? I mean, that I don't see? I said, how am I indicted? I mean, the letter was written. The copy was in the department. A copy sent to the register's office. It would be different if I had broken in somewhere and stolen. And you put it in as a fact. You know, she has stolen something. But it was all his allegations. And I finally told him, I said, I would like to meet Dr. whatever his name was and speak to him directly. And I'd like for the chairperson of the department to come and meet with us. I said, I don't want to have this as a private meeting between you and me. And I don't want to write a letter that's stuck in a file. That's just my word against his. I said, I really need a position to talk to somebody. I said, isn't that the American way? You get to confront your accuser? Turned into a 5-people meeting. It was in the registrar of the dean's office. And the chairperson did most of the talking. Here's what he said. Well, I respect my staff, and I wasn't endorsing or saying it was correct, but I had no reason not to follow through since my staff requested it. And so the dean said, about the students' rights. Why would you put in a file a person's opinion? It has, well, I just thought I'd share it with the rest of the university. I said, but I've never met Dr. whatever his name was. And he would look at me. He was a thin face, narrow nose, very, you know, his shoulders probably 32 inches to show, a very narrow, thin-looking person, would not sit down in his presence and would not look at me. But he wrote this 4-paragraph letter. And so in the dean be the resolution, I said that this letter is destroyed and all copies of it, that it's neither in my file inside the department nor in the file at the university. I said, and I have a question to the chairperson. I said, did you modify the locks in the building to accommodate that my key is only able to go into one room? Well, we have a requisition invoice. And I said, but there's no crime committed, yet you are indicting me. I said, what if I need dry ice? And I'm in the building in the evening. I said, will I not be able to finish my PhD dissertation or research because I don't have access to all facilities? And so the dean said, as university dean, I forbid you to modify anything in the laboratory with the said purpose of excluding this graduate student, that if you have made such requisition and you're getting locks that are changed, she shall have a key that goes in every building like every other graduate student in that department. So that was why Pittsburgh. And the way I found out is a previous whom I had favored saw the letter when she was about to file it. So how many of us have been, how many of us have things in our file that prevent us from moving forward, that prevents us from getting or has someone looking at us aslant?
Exactly. We're going to take a break. Dr.
Sure.
Dr.
Okay.
We're going to take a break and we'll be right back, okay?
All right.
Don't touch.
It's Thursday night and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody squeeze in. Say cheese.
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
All right, you guys, we are back, and we're talking with Dr. Bowles. Very interesting stories about her college years, about her life in general. And I'm like sitting here like, wow, you know, everybody has to deal with their situations and disparities in a different way. And she took it
how they say, you took the high road, even though they were doing these things to you, you took the high road and you continue on getting your education, because that was, like I said, you were focused on getting your education. Now, boy, you gave me a mindful. I ain't going to say a mouthful. I'm going to say a mindful. Because like you said, nobody knows somebody else's story until they open up their mouth and tell what's going on with them and all the things that they've been through, especially when you, like you said, during integration and being in a racial situation. And I can guarantee you, I truly understand how you feel. I can't feel the same thing you felt, because dealing with racism was different, because I dealt with it down here. So there's a little bit of difference in it. Racism is racism, but I dealt with it differently. I got violent with mine. So I beat up somebody.
Well,
with mine,
I don't have any reason to say don't, because people ask me, are you a pacifist? I had a brother once say to me, he says, well, you're such a pacifist. And I said, no, I had a goal, and I knew that through my dad had a dream through me. But as I would tell other young people when I talked to him, I said, I have gone to sleep on quite a number of nights on a wet pillow. And they would say, what are you talking about? It means you may not have seen me cry. I guess the one the registrar did when I read the letter, I was just kicked in the belly. I couldn't believe that letter, the person's opinion had gone that far. But there had been so many events, Salida, that I had to stand and I learned to hold my breath or bite down on the edge of my tongue to keep from letting the tears come to my eyes. And I get through that situation. But when I got to my home, or if I were in a quiet spot, like all of us, I have feelings. And I would tell, some people would say, well, you're so strong. I said, no, I'm not a rock. I'm not a machine. Mm-hmm. Did I cry? Yes. I used to carry, and this is kind of funny, and I think, Visine, red out, how you get red out of your eyes if you don't get sleep. Mm-hmm. I carry that in my purse, because I worked in some conditions in my career where I would literally go to the ladies' room and just cry. I mean, I'd have a muffled cry to get my system where I could just pour everything out emotionally and then put my red drops, red out, and go back to what I was doing. So, it wasn't that, I was totally impervious or that I was so strong. My weak moments just were not shared. And that's part of what I was saying when I said being so isolated. And I watched the Clarence Thomas trial with Anita Hill, and I listened to what she was saying, and it occurred to me, I know her pain. I have been in a situation where someone put sex on the line, and you had to say to yourself, should I fight this? What's going to happen if I fight it? Who do I go to? How do I get around this? I had a German professor at North Carolina State who refused to return my homework, and he instead, when he passed the papers back, would stop at my desk and say, come by my office, and I have something for you. And it got to the point, finally, he got so bold, I was sitting in the student union, and thank God there were people around who knew me. At least I'd interacted with enough that they knew of me, because if I'd been myself, I don't know if he would have grabbed my arm and strong-armed me away. I don't know, because he said to me, I was trying to write some kind of paper, and I had a person who was working with me, and he walks up and he says, in his German, good morning. And you refer to your professor as Herr Doktor, that's how the German professors are greeted. And then I finally looked at my paper, and I said, I was talking to my friend, not the professor. I said, I should just stay home in bed. Nothing's going right. That's not correct. And the professor looked at me. He looked at my face. He looked at my breast. He looked down to my feet. And he says, not in bed alone, I hope, and let all of that go to waste. I didn't know what to say. Boy, this is a 16-year-old. I opened my eyes wide and opened my mouth and shut it, and the person I was with stood up and he said, sir, we didn't invite you to this table, but I can invite you to leave. He was defending my honor. I didn't know what to say. Well, what do you say when that's a person of authority making such a comment? So, of course, my friend rescued me there. On another occasion, the same professor, it was thank God I was always in a place where there were people around. I was doing something in the student union again, and I was sitting at a desk. How you kind of find your own little space, and I had everything spread out. And he came up to the table, and I kind of saw him, but I was going to ignore him because there's no reason to say anything to him. This is after that public thing he said to me when my friend was there. And he pulls up a chair and he straddles it. You know how the back of the chair is against your chest? And he puts his elbows up on the back and he says to me, "I've never had a black woman." When my wife was pregnant, she was so beautiful. She just glowed. Then he sat there for a minute and he says, "Are you ever going to come by my office and pick up your papers? Because how do you know how you're doing in this course? I understand," and this is a Clarence Thomas part, "I understand you have to get an A or a B or you lose your funding." Now, what is that?
Yeah. He did his background check on you.
Well, yeah, so what do you do? See, I'm the vulnerable one. It's 8:30 at night. I'm sitting there in a place trying to do my homework. I don't have a brother, sister, mom, dad, somebody to call. I'm in this lily-white environment. I go home. A Mormon tells me I'm evil because I represent the first murder. And I'm sitting there trying to learn whatever it was, biochemistry, and a man is sitting there saying to me that he knows what my grade point average has to be, and he knows he hasn't returned any of my papers. People don't even think about that. Who should I have been able to call? Who do I go to? Where is my rescue? What kind of decision can a 16-year-old make under that kind of pressure?
Exactly. Now, are you telling me that you went to college at the age of 16?
Yes.
Okay. What was your IQ? What is your IQ, if you don't mind?
I don't know exactly. I always was, as a friend of mine said to me some years ago, Raph Katrina, I was always trying to get somewhere. I was going from and going from, and my incentive to get through high school, I had a horrible school experience. Again, I was the integration baby. They built a new high school in Shelby, North Carolina, and there were 5 black high schools that closed. And they tried to move, I don't know, some 200-plus students to this white school. And kids who were 11th to 12th graders refused to graduate from this school. And it was just a mass exit. And I was surprised there was not a U.S. attorney investigation or some kind of federal investigation of all these black students having no school. They closed Douglas, mm-hmm. Green, Bethel. They, you know, all of the schools that had black were gone, and they opened this big white school. And it's a brand spanking new school, and a few of us who were courageous enough, I started there at 10th grade. But prior to going to that school, I did a lot of independent study, and I was taking things like pre-calculus, and there's a whole nother story before why I was that advanced. I had an incident in childhood where I was shot, but that's another. And while I was convalescent, I kind of sped through a lot of academics. But at any rate, when I went to the 10th grade, they had this big meeting, and they were trying to decide what mascot for the high school. And the white kids wanted to call it Chris Confederates. Mm-hmm. And they wanted it to be this Confederate soldier with gray and red and the silver buttons and whatever. And I remember I stood up in this big assembly, and there were all these white people, big people in suits and whatever on the stage, and I guess they were superintendents of this and that. And I remember standing up, so they had to recognize me. I didn't know the right protocol. I was very young. In 10th grade, I was at 13 or 14. And I said to them, "You can't call it Confederates, not if you want black people to come here." And there was no response. I said, "Why can't you call it Crest Chargers and let the mascot be a horse?" Still no response. I said, "The horse can be white." Well, the comedy of the whole thing is, guess what the mascot is till this day? A fresh high
horse
in Shelby, North Carolina. A white horse reared on his back legs with his feet in some kind of combatant-like structure. Crest Chargers. Well, this little fly in the buttermilk stood up and said that because they were making a decision to be called Crest Confederates and gray in commemoration of the Confederate soldiers. So my entire educational background has been one of running, just trying to stay, you know, ahead of the hate, trying to stay ahead of the hurt, trying to stay ahead of. So I did not get to graduate, not in the traditional way from Crest High School. That's because I have always loved to write. And they had some money from the newspaper. Son went to Crest, and his father and others were gave us a printing press and a whole bunch of stuff to allow us to do our school newspaper. Well, here comes Belle, who decides to be an editorial writer, and she writes mm-hmm. this long article about black-white integration. And the mm-hmm. principal, Mr. Clayton, I'll never forget Mr. Clayton, called a full school assembly. This is the first year Crest was open. And he announced at the assembly there would be no junior-senior prom. And he said there would be no junior-senior prom, and I'm going to quote him, because no nigga boy will dance with a white girl while he was principal of Crest High School. Well, I burned that up. I wrote my article. I said he was just like the guy in Alabama and that John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, if they were alive, should send National Guard. Oh, I wrote a sizzling editorial. So mm-hmm. he just really disliked me, and I kept, you know, my distance. And then I was on the marketing committee, and we needed to sell some advertisement on newspaper. Well, I don't know if you remember, but in North Carolina, we still had drive-in theaters.
I remember.
And drive-in theaters, one of the places where they could have the X-rated movies, you know, the things now everybody has X-rated, but it was only in the drive-in where you could go see naked women and sex and stuff. So a group mm-hmm. of us went to these drive-in theaters, about three of them on the outskirts of town, and bought ads, sold ads to them. And we had to do these little blackouts, you know, paint out the women's breasts and paint out something else, the man's naked behind. But we ran their ads in the newspaper. Well, oh, my goodness, this good old Baptist, Southern Baptist environment had a fit, because they paid big money, $250 a page or something. It was unbelievable. And I was business manager for the newspaper, so they knew I had something to do with that. Let's see, what else did I do? Anyway, by the time came around for me to graduate, Mr. Clayton told every teacher I could not sit for my exam. He said, you cannot give her an exam. So here Belva was thinking, oh, my goodness. Now, here's how I say, again, the law of attraction or God or fate or however people think about my higher power. I had taken the SAT test. Now, here's the interesting thing. My parents did not have a lot of money. I tell you, there are eight kids. I have three sisters and four brothers. My brothers played ball, so they were big guys with big feet, and they had to get 2 and 3 pairs of tennis shoes, because we bought cheap tennis shoes, and they'd wear them right out. I mean, rip the size. The soles would be flapping. So Dad was always having to buy something for the boys. And here it came. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take PSAT or one of those tests, and it cost $200-some to take that test. We didn't have that money. And everybody around me was taking the SAT, and they said, but I want to go to college. Now, my brother, older brother, went on athletic scholarships. It didn't matter what his SAT score was. My older sister, I don't remember how her situation. I think she had a benefactor or someone knew somebody, so she went to our school. And I was holding out, needing the SAT, and I remember talking to Mom. Mom, that test got a big piece of money. They don't waive it. So Mom had saved some money in a coffee can from all her ironings and whatever, and she went in, petitioned my dad, and we came up with the money. But it was with much grief. I mean, Dad, money don't grow on trees and blue, ba-da-ba-da. I even worked during the summer, and I'd come in and hand him my check, you know, because the family needed the money. Long story short, I got registered. The day of the test, Mom didn't drive. We only had one car. Dad had something else. I was supposed to report for the test, as most people know, 8 a.m. that morning. You got to have some ID and whole bunch. Well, Dad ran late. It was 8:45 before he came home. It was pouring down raining. I was crying like a baby. All his money spent, and the test already started, and Dad didn't take me yet. So I jump in the car, and he barrels up to Crest High School, the school that had been mean and harsh to me, and I'm black and I'm late, you know, all that awful stuff. I got all this piled on my head. I jump out of the car. It's pouring down rain, and water's running down my neck. I get to the door. I recognize one of the teachers, and there he is, Mr. Walker. And I tell him, I said, I'm here. I'm late. He says, well, maybe you want to go dry off. So I run to the ladies' room, get all these paper towels, and mop my head and come running back. He has to take a fingerprint of me. I go in. So I tell you all this. They didn't give me any extra time. That the first section, I had to do it in like 10 minutes instead of 60 minutes or whatever. It was a hard, you know, standardized test. Okay. So we turn it in. I don't think about it anymore. I'm just sad. You know, Dad spent all that money. Mom spent all that money. I know I did badly. Well, I didn't do badly. about, I don't know how long it takes, 6 weeks after the test, they notified the school, you know, of the performance, and they didn't identify me because they didn't tell me anything nice. You know, the advisor probably knew I was the person. But they said someone had done an outstanding performance, the highest school they'd ever had in North Carolina's history. And so as it came closer and closer to graduation, principal said I couldn't take any tests. Now, the reason he did that is he did not want me to be valedictorian because he didn't want a nigga girl to recommend to school. So here I was at the end of the year, couldn't take a test, went to my pre-calculus course, and Mr. Walker said, I'm sorry, Belva, I can't give you the test. You know, we have like seniors week or whatever you can take, or 3 days a week or something, you take tests. So I was just saying, what am I going to do? What am I going to tell my parents? You know, you think about how high school kids commit suicide. I really had lots of burdens, and that really crossed my mind. Can I bear it? Then it came to me, I'll go talk to Mr. Clayton's boss. Don't know who it is, had no concept of what hierarchy people are. I walked from my house to Cleveland County, what they call county seat or whatever, school board. Walked in, it was probably like 3:30 one afternoon, about 8 miles. I've clocked it with the car now from my house at that time to where I walked that day. So it was late today because it took me that long to get there. And I walk in, and I say to this lady out front, I said, I need to talk to Mr. Clayton's boss. She said, who? I said, the principal of Crest High School. I need to talk to his boss. And she said, you mean the superintendent? Yes, ma'am. So I go in, and the superintendent has got his huge desk and his white hair and white eyebrows. And I stand there for a minute, and he says, yes. He looks up at me. I said, are you Mr. Clayton's boss? And he says, yes. I said, I need you to overrule him and let me take my exam. He said, what are you talking about? So I get in the story. He won't let me take my exam. And I guess he looked at me, and he said, well, make some phone calls. And he said, well, what do you suggest I do? So this is the thing that always got me. People in power who knew they could never offered me anything. I had to be the one to come up with an idea to fix my problem. And I look at that now, and that was so evil. How do I know what I want him to do, right? But I wasn't going to give it up. I said, well, I can come here and take my test. He says, you can't. I said, yes, sir, next Saturday. If you want me to come, I'll take all my tests next Saturday. Well, that's the only solution I know, not knowing he could just tell the man back up and let her take them like everybody else. So long story short, I took 6 exams back to back on that Saturday and was able to, you know, get my grades so that I could graduate with my class. And because I couldn't be valedictorian, they told me I could do the invitation and the closing, which means I could pray. And they would not allow me to sit on the stage. I had to sit in the front row with the class where the top students, like, you know, the best athlete and the queen, whatever it is, the court queen. Yeah, I wasn't allowed to sit on the stage. I know. I'm telling you stuff that people wouldn't even believe. So I'm sitting not on the stage, and I'm sitting, and my parents didn't come to my graduation. They weren't comfortable among all those white people. Anyway. So I'm sitting on the front, and the people sitting on either side of me, you know, you're alphabetized, and I had been around these people always, and I don't know, we're kind of chattering a little bit, and we're waiting, and all of a sudden, a fellow named Gene looked at me and said, Belva, they called your name. I said, yeah, you're just trying to get me. He said, no, they called your name. I said, yeah, get me to stand up. So all of a sudden, people stood up, started clapping, and they kept clapping. And I looked, and he said, oh, I'm not kidding. He wasn't a jokester, so I stood up, and they clapped louder. And when I stood up, look, 2 white men came walking out of the eaves of the stage and came to the podium and motioned for me. So I go around and go up on the stage, walk over, and I'm saying, what in the world? They were from the National Testing Center out of New Jersey, and they came to present me with the plaque for having earned the score that I earned on the SAT score and to present me with the National Merit Fellowship.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
And you're talking about that what egg the principal would have had on his face if I had not been able to graduate. But look, he didn't help me. I did it. Of course, now, this what they call the advisor, oh, we're so proud of her. And she, I'm looking at her like, you, no lips. You know, cause she didn't have any lips. She used to draw lipstick on her face to pretend like she had some lips. You know, sometimes their lips are so thin. I said, look at her, like, you know, lips, something. And, of course, they're saying a picture, and then Clayton wants to go stand beside me. And I'm looking at him like, you won't even let me graduate. So that was the facade or the fakery. So that's why under, you know, going under, I wanted wanted to go to UCLA, but Dad did not want me to leave the state, so I went to North Carolina State. Only person who did not go to an HBCU. Mm-hmm. So that's a long story, but I've only given you a snippet. I've always been trying to push away from all of the horribleness to get to where I needed to be. So, yeah, I've been running for a long time.
Yes, you have been running for a long time. Now, let's talk about your business, what you're doing now, and your book. We're going to get to your book right before we end it, okay?
Okay.
Let's talk about what you're doing now.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm trained as a clinician, and I worked actively for 22 years in various settings as a physician and emergency room doctor, primary care doctor, a private clinic doctor. And after Katrina, the thrill for clinical really wasn't there anymore because most of my patients were scattered, and I lost my clinic, and I was in terrible debt. And to boot, I had identity theft, which was still plagues me now, but it was extremely difficult in the beginning. So to rebuild myself, I have started to do concierge medicine, which means I advise people, particularly veterans. I'm a member of the Coalition mm-hmm. Against Maltreatment of Veterans, and I've written quite a few service-connected evaluations and allow people to go before the panel and present and actually get their service-connected funding. I've worked with certain people who are actually trying to get justice when they have a loved one that has been injured or died under the hands of the VA hospital. And between mm-hmm. that and my writing, I tell people that I took a sabbatical from clinical and started writing. I have a number of blog pages where I wrote of my New Orleans experience, and I have several blog pages where I give out alternative medicine health tips. I did go to University of San Francisco about 4 years ago, and I got 2,500 continuing medical education credits, allowing me to say that I now have the training for alternative medicine. And I do herbal stuff with lemongrass is a lot of the herbal stuff, and I certainly evaluate a person's health and advise them as to how herbal or alternative medicine can help them in whatever their malady. Of the books that I've mm-hmm. written, three of which are white papers. White papers are generally an opinion or an authority on a subject. One of them has been presented to the U.S. Senate. It was called Potable Water. It had support of a industry where they wanted to go into a disaster site and create drinkable water through an ionization process mounted on a mobile vehicle. And that mobile vehicle actually went to Haiti in October a year ago, and they used the technology mm-hmm. that I described and was presented in the Potable Water book. I also wrote a white paper on the obesity of youth in America, and that was used in a presentation that the Lynx International, actually, and Tuskegee University had funding for those interested in trying to identify young black youth who are overweight. And I wrote that treatise talking about the risks they have if they're more than 30 pounds overweight by the time they're 13. And then the mm-hmm. final white paper, which became published as a book, is about senior citizens. It's the disparity of health care for black senior citizens. And I brought to the forefront some of the experiences I had working in Louisiana, South Carolina, Missouri, Alabama. And a lot of times physicians do not give the same care to the elderly black that Medicare will pay for. And it has some very terrible ramifications. Many people may not know, but blood pressure is treated differently in America if you're white or black. The mm-hmm. level that they tolerate among blacks is much higher. The medications that they give blacks are less effective. And if you do a review, and now we come to my final book, Salute a Reaction, I actually went through and itemized how medical racism has affected health care for black Americans in the United States. And part of the information in that book identifies that hemodialysis is a prepaid service. It actually is allocated money by the U.S. Senate. It's run by only two organizations in the United States, and 68% of all people on hemodialysis are Black Americans.
Oh, man.
And if you look at the statistics, they claim we're only 12.1% of the population. But one of the reasons there's such a high incidence of us on that form of support is hypertension and diabetes. And I know in medical school, they said that for a Black person having a blood pressure of 140 over 90, they tell everybody it was borderline. But if you go to the American Cardiac Association or any of the American Medical Association continuing education seminars, they're teaching 120 over 60 for everybody else. So they allow Black Americans to run around with hypertension. Oh, that's a big difference. And many of us, unfortunately, we're looking at 160 over 110. I mean, I have actually seen blood pressure of Black Americans, 240 is the highest, 240 over 120. Was in Lake Providence, Louisiana, and it was a 37-year-old man, and he was walking around talking to me. I couldn't believe he hadn't stroked. But the whole business, and in the book Fluid Reaction, I actually first just talk about obesity and talk about how there are additives allowed in our food which are intended to make us addicted to it. That the whole marketing, when they say Lay's potato chip, you can't eat just one. Guess what? They know they've added something that makes you eat one and need another one. There is a real neuropeptide, a brain stimulus, that makes you eat more. Now, here's what gets me. If you look at the incarceration rate in the United States and you say, well, the predominant incarcerated are Black Americans, we have the highest incarceration rate in the world, and of the people incarcerated, Black Americans are the highest. Well, Celia, you know this. We've talked about this in other shows. But many of those in there are for drug offenses. And look how two-faced it. What is the irony that you can use addictive products in food and have the United States make laws that prevent anyone from being able to sue you? And then you go out and you do marijuana or even crack cocaine, which is only 15% cocaine, and spend an entire lifetime behind bars.
Isn't addiction addiction?
As I'm saying, it's a straight up setup. And part of what I try to do in Fluid Reaction, I do it in systematically. It's not a big book. I think it has like 150 some pages. If you look at the table of contents, it has five sections. The first section I talk very specific about healthcare, and I show whomever that reads it that part of the issues for us having high diabetes and high hypertension and renal failure has to do with corporate greed. That pharmaceutical companies are making trillions of dollars a year. And part of the scheme is they give you a medicine to treat one problem, knowing they will cause two other ones. Let me give an example so it's not abstract. If you have high blood pressure and you're a Black male, and I give you a diuretic called HCTZ, I know you will end up with gout. It's more than 80% chance you will get gout. Gout is very painful. So in order to treat gout, I will prescribe you allopurinol, and if you have real bad flares, I'll have to also give you colchicine. So here I have you taking two medicines to combat a condition I knew I would cause by giving you this specific antihypertension. Now, why is this bad? There must be 30 choices of what to give a person for hypertension. Why would I choose the one thing that would ensure that you'll need two other pills?
Yeah, money, money, money. Like you said, corporate greed.
So there are many examples of that kind of thing. It was shown many years ago, probably in the late 60s, early 70s, that there's a medication called hydroxyzine that works very effectively on Black Americans' hypertension. It's used in the ER setting. It's sometimes used in the ICU setting, but it's a very rare medication given to any Black person for hypertension. The medicine they prefer is clonidine. And I remember in the classroom they would say you give clonidine, And when you're talking about the white majority, you never prescribe clonidine. You give it only in an emergency, in the ER, or in an ICU setting, because clonidine is a blood pressure medication that has what we call central acting. In other words, it handles blood pressure by working through the brain. Mm-hmm. Well, anything that works through the brain has what we call a hair trigger. So if mm-hmm. you miss a dose, if you're supposed to be taking it every 6 hours, and you don't take it every 6 hours. You take it, oh, I take it now, and then 9 hours later you remember it. Oh, I didn't take my clonidine. And then you skip some more, and you remember you didn't take your clonidine. Well, because clonidine is centrally active, the number one effect of missed clonidine, or as we say, non-compliance, is stroke. Did you hear what I said?
Yes.
Stroke.
Yes.
So
yes.
Why would you prescribe a medicine for someone to handle on their own? It's not an MICU setting. It's not an ER setting where a nurse will check you every 15 minutes or a doctor will come see you. It's in your home and in your pocket. And if you are non-compliant, your risk for stroke is multiplied 3 to 4-fold.
Man.
It is the number one prescribed medicine to most black people for hypertension is clonidine. Number one medicine prescribed for most people with high blood pressure is HCTZ.
Mm-hmm.
And then so we wonder why are the black folks having bouts, and why are so many of our older black people stroking and pulling, dragging one leg or losing the use of an arm, and no one speaks out.
Mm-hmm.
So in my book, I called it Salutary Action. It says I wrote a few quotes, and one of the quotes that starts the book, if you buy right behind the table contents, it says, "Man has no nobler function than to defend the truth."
Yep.
And that's what I said. That's a salutary action. If you want to salute me for anything, salute me for defending the truth. And you might as well hear the truth. So after I talk about the health care, I go into the clinical consequences of obesity, and so many people ignore what has now become an epidemic in America, because you look at our children and you look at so many people carrying so much extra weight, and a lot of the problems that they're suffering has to do with adipose tissue and something called visceral fat. And all of that comes about if you have more than 30 pounds, more than the ideal weight. Then I talk about how you can deal with the challenges of obesity, and that's when I talk about the addictive foods. How can we lose weight when the government will actually subsidize the very people who are putting addictive stuff in our food? You know, if you're in a low income where you can't buy an apple, I talked to one lady, she had type 2 diabetes, and I was doing the obligatory lecture, you know, you need not to eat this and you have to be careful. She looked at me and waited for me to finish. And she took a deep breath and said, "Doctor, I'm taking care of 3 of my grandkids, and I don't get any money from anywhere else. And I'm on a fixed income." I think she had something like $380 a month fixed income. Mm. And she said, "And I try to make sure they eat. Do you know, for what I pay for one apple, I can go to Dollar Tree and buy cheese puffs, and everybody can eat?" And I had to, you know, just sit there for a moment. I just felt, oh, Salita, I felt drained. I could cry. I thought, yes, it's real. But, you know, if you were taking care of people, won't you go to Dollar Store and buy that artificial food, that oil byproduct, you know, cheese puffs didn't have any food in it at all. If you ever read the ingredients, they don't mention corn. They just say something about petroleum byproduct with orange color number 76 and some. You look at it, it's like you're eating just byproduct. That's like rubbish. But if you buy a big bag of Cheetos, everybody feel like they had something to eat.
Mm.
You know? You buy this big bottle, 3-liter bottle for a dollar of some off-brand soda that's full of corn syrup, they feel like they've had something to drink. So those of us, you know, sitting back trying to tell someone how to live their life, an apple costs about $1.15 each.
Yeah.
I mean, if you looked at apples, there was so much a pound. I like different kinds of apples, and I was in this one shop, and I saw, oh, they have Pink Lady, which is a very fragrant apple. It's a pretty flash knife. And I rushed over to see it. It was $3.99 a pound. town. I said, Pink Lady, you can be, I'm leaving you at the bus stop. There's no way I'm picking you up. I'm like, $3.99 for apples?
Yeah,
so,
I believe
that.
How do you like it's off limits to the people who can't afford? I mean, they can't.
There you go. There you go. So if I have type 2 diabetes and I have high cholesterol and I have high blood pressure and you tell me eat more leafy vegetables and I go into a grocery store and you have collard greens at $2.18 a pound and you have kale $3 a pound and if it says organic it just flipped up to $4 a pound, then it's a joke. The very people who need to eat those foods can't afford it. And what they can afford, the government allows them to add addictive compounds and know there's no food quality.
Exactly.
I mean, if you
exactly.
eat cheese puffs, all you're doing is putting calories into your body. It has no food. There's no vitamin A. And then you say, oh, that's orange like a carrot. Yeah, but they put orange dye number 76 in there. It doesn't have any beta carotene. So if they're allowed to do things that looks like you're doing something right all stage. So I talk about the challenges. Then I actually, and this was the one that took me the longest to get the second edition out. I actually have a chapter called Medical Racism, Healthcare Obstruction. And what I did there is I did a little history lesson there. I talked about the American eugenics legacy. I gave instances of racial discrimination, how it induces some health problems, you know, how the very act of how a doctor talks to you or does not talk to you or what a surgeon tells you or does not tell you can impact how you receive your health care. Then I went into the story of the Black American Holocaust, and that's what I call death by syphilis. I refused to call it the Tuskegee Experiment. You know, that was intentional to evoke this historically Black university's name, and that's why they could actually lure Black people into this program because they used the name of Tuskegee. It had nothing to do with Tuskegee, by the way. It was the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Yes, the same CDC who's supposed to be handling Ebola. And I love this one, the Public Health Service, the same people who gave us our polio shots and our different vaccines. Well, I laugh because we both know we've talked about the vaccine stuff. Then I talked about the forced sterilization of American children. A lot of people don't know about that. I talked about the Immigration Restriction League and how until 1964, and I did say 64, Black people or people of color could not immigrate to the United States. They could visit, but they couldn't immigrate. So I brought that up because we truly now, in 2014, 50 years since the immigration embargo was lifted, we truly have a population of African Americans, people who can go home to the village, go home back to their country, and that kind of muddies the water for the Black Americans. We've been here for 600 plus years. We don't have a home. We don't have a village.
Exactly.
And the way in which the government kind of lumps anybody with color into the same boat, I think Black Americans need to have an outcry and say, hold up, hold up. We're the ones who need restitution. If someone declares himself African American, they're from Nigeria, they're legitimate. You know, they can go back to their roots. But those of us who were snatched up from the ground and our roots were torn out of the soil, I think we need to maintain some separate identity lest we get blended. We're already blended with white women minority, you know. We need to start fighting
that. That's true. That's true.
But I brought that out when I talked about the Immigration Restriction League because I think our problems are different from the African-American who's a recent transplant. I also talked about Marcus Garvey. He's so important in Black American history because even now when the Honorable Minister Farrakhan talks about separatism and has asked for I don't know how many states to be dedicated to Black Americans, and there are a number who said, yes, we need to have our separate. I told someone recently that has already been tried. In 1854, under President Monroe, whenever he was in office, Marcus Garvey started a ship line. Now, he came out of Jamaica. And several thousand Black Americans were returned to the coast of Liberia. They had either bought their freedom or had somehow been indentured slaves and were granted their freedom after so many years of service. And they were transported back to Liberia. And, in fact, the capital of Liberia is called Monrovia in honor of President Monroe. So it's not that it hadn't been tried. It just was not successful because eventually in the Jim Crow days, or just before that, they indicted Marcus Garvey for advertisement fraud. Can you believe that? And he was extradited back to Jamaica. So I tell the story of Marcus Garvey and how President Monroe had his Liberian colony and how America abandoned that colony. I also talk about how right after 1864, when we had the forced Emancipation Proclamation, there was a decision, a lot of people don't know this, by the U.S. government to, well, you hear the allusion, but you never get the facts. What, 40 acres and a mule? There was a presidential decree that all Southern Black people recently released from slavery should receive as reparation 40 acres and a mule. Well, guess what? General William T. Sherman issued a field order number 15, and reversed a presidential decree. No one ever talks about that. How does a general have the power, unless your name is Obama, you know? They try to reverse and tear up everything he does. Well, it has happened before. General William Sherman issued a field order number 15 that appealed the 40 acres and a mule. Had you ever heard that one before? Well, I document that information.
I haven't heard that before.
It is in the book. And I also talk about,
we're going to take a break and then you can come back. And then before we close out, I want you to talk about your radio show and what's coming up next, okay?
Yeah, sure will.
Okay.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in physics, I learned that I'm a loser.
Today in school, I learned that I'm ugly and useless. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. In history, I learned that I'm trash.
Today in school, I learned that I have no friends. In English, I learned that I make people sick. And at lunch, I learned that I sit on my own because I smell. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes
me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. And in math, I learned that I'm trash.
The only thing I didn't learn today
is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Okay, we are back with Dr. Bowles, and she has some delightful stories. She's told us about her career. She told us about all her school and her education and what she went through with being integrated into a society that actually had issues with us. And she talked about her book, and she talked about most of her work. So not only does she do that, you guys, this lady is, like she said, she goes from one thing to another to another to another. And she also has a radio show, and I want you to tell them a little bit about the radio show and when can they hear it. And then I want you to tell us where we can get a copy of your books. We're going to do that.
Okay. My radio show is a radio blog talk show, and it's called Getting It Right with Dr. Bowles. Mm-hmm. And it airs at 4 p.m. on Thursdays. That's Central Standard Time. So Getting It Right with Dr. Bowles, 4 p.m. on Thursday. The topics that I've covered in the last two shows, and the one that's upcoming I think is in that same series, has to do with Ebola. I have been a number of shows talking about vaccines because I love doing medical science, And there's a strong theory, call it conspiracy theory or whatever, that vaccination on the continent of Africa has been the inoculation of people with HIV. And the most recent discussions is that the Ebola outbreak happens to be in only three countries in Africa, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. And that also corresponds, unfortunately, with some American bases in those countries. And the suspicion grows because the Center for Disease Control and Prevention owns the patent for Ebola virus. So I'm waiting to see how that pans out. But in one show, I talked about the curiosities of how two white missionaries who were infected were flown immediately to one place at Emory in Atlanta. And within 3 days, they were cured and everything was great. And the only fatality has been a Liberian man who arrived in Dallas because the nurses who were exposed, well, one is virus free because she went to the White House and hugged President Obama. And there was two cases that came into New York, and you don't hear anything else. They obviously were cured. My question as a physician scientist is, how do they know exactly how to fight this virus? And the missionaries coming out of Liberia, but there was nothing available for this Liberian man who was healthy enough to seek help September 25th, sent home, and returned September 28th, 3 days later, to die 3 days after that. So, you know, there's a lot of questions unanswered. In the last show, I talked about the origin of Ebola, how it was first shown a presence in Africa in 1978, and it first showed up in Sierra Leone and then Liberia, and it almost at the same time. And there's some questions because if you follow history, Secretary of State Kissinger and the president at that time talked about how important it was to control the population of the world. And there was a presidential affidavit signed saying that as the United States has a responsibility to police the growth of population of the world. And that's where the whole conversation about vaccination, the use of Depo-Provera, and some of the scandals that had come out. Salita, I don't know if I talked to you about it, but there was a group of black Jewish people who immigrated to Israel, and they mandated as a term of their immigration that the women receive the Depo-Provera shots. And when someone was wondering why the population wasn't growing in that area, it was uncovered that these shots had rendered the women sterile. So there was an international outcry of was this intentional, and was this also a practice of eugenics? So the upcoming show, I'm talking more about depression and the causes of depression. I think with Robin Williams, you know, I really enjoyed his acting and that he committed suicide. And some say that he had been given a diagnosis of Parkinsonian and he just did not want to face a life where he could not be in control of his own movements. And I think it's important that we talk about when you have added stressors, how depression can creep up on you and what you can do to avoid it. So the upcoming show has to do with recognizing depression, and the Yuletide season or the holiday season can be the all-time worst. I think that's the number one time from November to December for suicide and suspected suicide to occur. So that's the radio show. I do all kind of contemporary topics. A number of them I do self-help. I do motivation. I've had a number of interviews with very interesting people, and I do have MP3s available for those who would like to have copies, but you can hear any of my archived shows, and I have well over, I think I last count, I was surprised, it's close to 200, and that is Getting It Right with Dr. Bowles, 4 p.m., Standard Time on Thursdays.
Man. So tell us how we can get a copy of your book.
Okay. If you want to order a copy, I am on Amazon. I am on Kindle. But the best port that I found is through CreateSpace. So let me give you a website. You go to https://, then you do your /, www.createspace, write it as one word, CREATESPACE, com/ I give you the last two digits because this takes you right to my office page. And the digits that follows that last slash is 4825636.
Okay.
And if you go to that site, you can do a little. Sure. https://// www.createspace.com/4825636. And that will take you to my office page. It gives you a little bit of narrative about me, a little bit of narrative about the book, and you can order it by putting it in your little shopping cart.
Awesome, awesome. This has been a wonderful, wonderful interview. You stay busy, as usual. If you guys,
well, I didn't mention I'm a teacher right now. I went back to the classroom. I always love to teach, and
yes.
I am an instructor at Louisiana State University, and I'm on the Alexandria campus, and I am teaching chemistry, and I am really loving it. I just went to school myself and got my online training certificate, so I'm looking forward to being able to reach out as an online instructor as well.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. I told you guys she never stops, and we have some little irons in the fire ourselves as partners on some stuff,
yes.
But we're not going to talk about that now. We'll bring that up at a later date.
I did share a face-to-face with your friend today, and she was delighted that I stopped by to talk to her, but I thought I shared an idea.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
With our friend?
Yes. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I
heard
I do,
you
I
were a little upset, and I went by and I said, I came by just to check on you, and she said, yes, I'm mad. So when I left her laughing, so I cheered her up. Yes, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Bowles. I'm wishing you much, much luck in everything that you put your hands on. Like I said, you're an awesome person. I wouldn't have invited you on the show if I didn't think you were an awesome person in the things that you do. Being part of a community, you do your community work, you work with people, you volunteer, you give your all, and I think it's a wonderful thing that you do all those things, and I know God is looking down on you, blessing you in everything that you do. Keep up the good work. Continue doing what you're doing. Keep educating us in every way you can, because I know you're good at that. I want to say thank you again, you guys. This has been a wonderful show, and stay tuned next Wednesday. We have another guest that's coming on. Ajie Moore is her name, and we'll be talking to her. We'll be interviewing her, continuing our Women in Motion series here on Say Your Please Radio Network, Blog Talk Radio. And this is Selena, and I'm signing off, and I say goodbye.
Join us next time on the Say Your Peace Radio Network as we keep you informed, educated, and enlightened.